I'm Peggy Waymire, and this is the World Vision Report. This week, a showdown in Pakistan's Swat Valley. The army battles the Taliban, and local residents flee in droves.
In Swat, there is so much fighting going on. The Taliban is everywhere, and no one is free. Where will I go in the future?
Girls in Brazil learn to box. And musicians around the world sing together, miles apart.
I wanted to try to get different types of instruments playing together that ordinarily wouldn't be something people would hear. So I knew that I wanted to add South African choirs, sitars in Asia, combining with steel guitars in New Orleans.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In Pakistan's Swat Valley, a peace deal between the government and the Taliban has collapsed. Thousands of civilians are fleeing the fighting between the Taliban and the Pakistani military. Journalist Nahid Mustafa was recently there. We just caught up with her after she spoke to some of the people caught in the crossfire.
Well, one of the people that I spoke to has basically left. He took his family and he fled. He said it was very tough getting out just because of the sheer numbers of people trying to leave. And he finally was able to make it out through an alternate route, is now in a smaller town. And he says it's quite dire. And about 2 hours ago, I spoke to somebody who's still in Mingora, which is the largest town in Swat. He said for 3 days there's been no electricity, water supplies are running short, food is running short. He's basically holed up in his house with his wife and kids. Everything is shut down. He runs a newspaper. He says the newspaper hasn't been published in 2 days. And he says the town is in the hands of the Taliban, that he doesn't see any government forces on the ground. He doesn't see any police on the ground. But there's constant shelling and constant shooting coming from Pakistani forces. There's helicopter gunships. And that in the last 2 days, they've lost about 50 civilians, women, children, old people. But because everything is shut down, they can't take them to the hospitals. They can't bury their dead. So it's quite a painful situation there right now.
And how are the Pakistanis responding to the refugees who are fleeing out of the region?
There's a tremendous amount of sympathy. You know, people try to do what they can to give people jobs and try to help them out as best they can. But, you know, it's a struggle. I mean, Pakistan is not a rich country. It spends a disproportionate amount of its budget on the military. But overall, you know, the people there are struggling. So while there's a lot of sympathy, there's also a lot of I think people also feel really helpless. It's one thing when there's violence in the tribal areas, but it's a whole other thing when this type of thing happens in Pakistan proper. People are really, really shocked and kind of aghast at what's going on.
Last month, a video circulated all over of a girl being flogged by the Taliban, and that created quite an outrage. Tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Well, you know, it was interesting because I asked somebody locally about that video, and he said, and I also pointed out that, you know, there was tape that came out from Swat of the local people protesting and saying, no, the video's a fake, it's a fake, there's no way that this happened in Swat, we didn't see it. And I asked him about that, and his point was that, you know, he in particular had no way of knowing whether the video was real or fake. I mean, nobody had told him otherwise. But the reason that they protested and sort of defended, I guess, quote-unquote defended the Taliban, was that their fear was that if this incident escalates into something bigger and the military comes back in to take action against the Taliban, they just didn't want to get caught up in the fighting again. They just wanted.
And that's exactly what's happening now.
And that's exactly what's happening now. Just, you know, I just keep coming back to the idea that it's the people that are stuck in the middle. You know, these people that are just trying to live their lives and get on with things, who are caught between, you know, what the military wants and what the Taliban wants. Their thing is, if we're living under the Taliban, as long as it's peaceful, you know, we're willing to do it. We just want the fighting to stop.
Nahid Mustafa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Nahid Mustafa is a freelance journalist based in Toronto. Pakistanis were already fleeing the Swat Valley before this latest fighting broke out, hundreds of thousands of them. Some of them ended up in refugee camps. Others headed for major cities and moved in with relatives or rented apartments. 55-year-old Sher Ali Khan is one of them. He fled his village in the Swat Valley 9 months ago. Sher Ali Khan now lives in a rented house in a Pashtun settlement on the outskirts of Karachi. Khan, his wife, and 13 children are waiting for the day it's safe enough to return home. Here's Mr. Khan in his own words.
We came to Karachi because my wife was sick and we couldn't get treatment in Swat. The fighting had been going on for a week already. We had to borrow money from my son to get here. In Swat, I owned a lot of farmland. I had cattle and fruit orchards. We assume it's all gone, but we haven't gotten any news of what's happened. We're mentally tortured more than anything else. Our money is almost gone now. In Swat, there is so much fighting going on. The Taliban is everywhere, and no one is free. And here in Karachi, they call us terrorists. Where will I go in the future? That's what troubles me most. I have no problem living under the Taliban or the Pakistani government. It's peace that we want. I'm not a criminal, so I have nothing to fear of any government. I'm comfortable in Swat. It's my homeland. As long as my family is safe and secure, I will be fine. I am illiterate. I don't really understand politics or how to run the government. But I don't believe the Taliban or the government is working towards peace. I think they both have their own agenda. It wouldn't be that hard to make peace because in our communities we solve problems through dialogue. So, if they really wanted peace, they would sit down and have a discussion.
Reporter Jessica Partnow produced that story. Funding for the report was provided by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. The conflict in the Swat Valley is just the kind of problem Dr. Paula Green tries to solve. Dr. Green has spent her life helping people in war-torn countries find peaceful alternatives to violence. And a few years ago, she founded a program to do just that. It's called CONTACT. That stands for Conflict Transformation Across Cultures. From Brattleboro, Vermont, Judy Martin reports.
Come and speak on their behalf now. Everyone, get back! Move!
A towering man in his 20s wields a large stick as he yells at a mob of people trying to break into a building.
We want to see our leader. Why have you taken our leader?
Several dozen men and women push against a barricade of military figures blocking the doors. Some hold up signs demanding the freedom of their leader. Others clench their fists in anger.
Let's go around and have our demonstrate peacefully on the other side.
This is a training exercise. It's part of a three-week program called CONTACT that's held every summer at the School for International Training in Vermont. Its purpose? To teach peace-building techniques to mediate conflict. The 65 participants here now are from 30 war-torn countries. They work for humanitarian, religious, and educational organizations. These students are eerily spot on in their roles, mostly because they've played them out to one degree or another in their own lives. That includes Christine Uwayezu.
There in Rwanda, it was very, very hot because I saw by my eyes my father killed.
Uwayezu was 11 years old during the Rwandan genocide. A rebel militia stormed her home and brutally executed her father in front of her. She escaped, but was separated from her remaining family. Eventually, she fled to Kenya. She received a degree in international studies. And now, at 24 years old, she hopes to return to Rwanda someday to counsel women who are victims of war.
This program is very important to me because I went through head. I know the worst of the war conflict.
Conflicts that Dr. Paula Green, the founder of the CONTACT program, has seen firsthand. A psychologist by training, she's traveled to many war-ravaged countries to learn and then share methods of conflict resolution. In 1997, Green decided she wanted people who had experienced conflict to share their stories face-to-face.
What we know they take back with them is a commitment to work for peace a very, very changed understanding of their own prejudices and biases. People meet each other, befriend each other, understand that what we have in common as human beings far outweighs anything else that might come between us.
The program has had its successes, Green tells me. For example, a colonel in the Indian Army became an international peacekeeper in Sierra Leone after learning mediation strategies. And a Nigerian attorney is now educating factory workers on their labor rights with his newly acquired negotiation skills. Green says she gets hundreds of applicants for the contact program every year.
I look for people who will have the most clout in transferring their learnings back into their communities. So I try to make sure that we have people from many of the regions and many of the countries in the world where violence has occurred.
I would like to request if you can internalize the role, take in the role.
In this classroom, about 50 people sit at school desks placed in a circle. In the center, students play out the conflict between the Chinese government and the people of Tibet. Some of them are actual Tibetan activists who escaped that country and can never return. Some act as the Tibetan people, and others play the Chinese government and military.
As the military of China, how was it facing these people here?
I didn't feel, just kind of doing a job, I guess.
We're just doing your job.
So I don't really have an emotion. I just make sure that
the exercise is designed so that students learn about the psychology of the culture clash that governs this conflict in hopes of better understanding struggles within their own countries. Throughout the day, videos are shown of past conflicts, including this film of the 1960s civil rights demonstrations and Martin Luther King Jr. giving his I Have a Dream speech.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
The Contact Program encourages students to try to understand all sides of a conflict, says Chaya Sharma. Sharma is a businesswoman in Nepal. She's working on the reconciliation between two groups of women divided by a brutal history, those who've been victims of government violence and those who've suffered at the hands of the Maoist insurgency.
So the best way to bring them together was first embark on their identity as mothers, as women, and then work towards a common cause. So that is how I'm here, to really understand the dynamics of conflict and where I can contribute to bringing changes.
And Chaya Sharma says not everything she's learned has been taught through the spoken word. Back in the classroom, students learn a song about peace that originates from Senegal. The Contact Program welcomes its next class in June. For the World Vision Report, I'm Judy Martin in Brattleboro, Vermont.
Coming up, Somali pirates have been pushed off the front pages by other news this week, but they're still out there and still attacking ships. We find out why they do what they do, just ahead on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff recently ordered a review of U.S. strategy to combat piracy. That was after pirates attacked the American ship Maersk Alabama off the coast of Somalia. But even before the review is finished, experts agree the solution to piracy can't be purely military. It has to address the problems that gave rise to piracy in the first place. Ishan Tharoor is a writer for Time Magazine International. He's explored the roots of Somali piracy, and he joined us from Hong Kong to talk about it. You recently wrote an article for Time Magazine's website about this ongoing problem of piracy along the coast of Somalia, and you took an angle most of us haven't heard much about. Give us a little history of this piracy movement off the coast of Somalia over the years.
Well, after the fall of the last functional government in Somalia in 1991, you had no coast guard, you had no functioning authority monitoring its waters, and Somalia does have the longest coastline in continental Africa. So what happened was, in this vacuum, fishing fleets from across the world, from Spain, as far away as Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, all came to these waters off the coast of Somalia and the Horn of Africa. These waters are quite fertile compared to other parts of the Indian Ocean. And basically what happened, as some UN observers have told me, was you saw a feeding frenzy and a kind of free-for-all of illegal trawling, unregulated fishing. And in this kind of environment, the average Somali fisherman, who has very minimal means and no infrastructure to really support him, was frozen out. These are fishermen who, you know, are just casting nets. They have no real equipment beyond that. And that kind of created what you could describe as kind of ad hoc militia groups, Somali coastal coast guards, who emerged from the various small fishing villages and ports along the Somali coast, places now that we identify as pirate dens. And they began really initially just trying to fight back against a lot of the illegal trawlers.
So piracy began as just local groups of fishermen banding together off the coast to try to protect their waters and protect their fishing with illegal trawlers. Who are the pirates of today? I assume they're not still all disgruntled fishermen.
Not at all. Most of the pirates today, you can safely say, never were fishermen in the first place, probably don't know how to swim or cast a net. These are just people who realize that piracy is the boom industry in Somalia at the moment, the only boom industry, and it's grown mass appeal. And what's happened is that the whole problem has kind of metastasized and grown to the point that we're dealing not with just militias, we're dealing with organized networks, we're dealing with local officials who are in the pay of a whole network of pirate elders, and also just the levels of communication, the levels of planning, are just completely different from what they were a decade ago.
So it's really all about the money now.
It is all about the money now. But again, one has to kind of still point fingers at the rest of the world's neglect. A lot of the ways that the pirates' appetite for ransom and for hijacking ships was whetted was because when they attacked illegal fishing ships, a lot of the companies supporting these endeavors paid the ransom without asking too many questions because they didn't want to be outed in the international community for transgressing international maritime laws and overfishing and illegally fishing in Somalia.
I see. So it became really easy. The pirates learned early on that it was really easy to get money from these ships.
Right, exactly.
And how much money can these pirates really make in ransom in 1 year?
Well, it's hard to tell. I think the current estimate now is that some $150 million a year is given in ransom.
Who gets that money and where does it end up?
It's a great question. I wonder, there are a lot of reports of pirates buying condominiums in Mombasa and other East African towns, of ransom money funding trips to Europe and other kind of expensive getaways. It's difficult to trace where all this goes. But it's clear that it's pumping in funds and money and giving it an illusion of a life that many Somalis could never have imagined before.
And it's interesting because what would really stop them, since the big ships now aren't allowed to carry guns and there's really no rule of law in the area?
Well, you are increasingly seeing some kind of resistance to pirates. In the northern Puntland region of Somalia, which a lot of people say is the hotbed of piracy, some of the coastal villages and cities are putting together their own vigilante anti-piracy fleets. There was a recent episode also of some sailors fighting back and resisting the pirates with Molotov cocktails and other sorts of devices. So there are some encouraging signs within Somalia of a kind of local backlash to the issue, because there are many Somalis who are hurting from this. It isn't as if the entire country is benefiting from the plunder of a few.
Ishan Tharoor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Ishan Tharoor is a writer for Time Magazine International. If you'd like to read his article, you can link to it from our website, worldvisionreport.org. Gun and drug violence in Brazil has turned major cities like Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo into war zones. And there's a growing problem of young people who live in the city slums or favelas turning to crime. But a group in Rio de Janeiro is trying to turn kids away from guns and gangs. Amelia de Sousa has the story.
Ah, In an empty gym in the favela Complexo da Maré, Jacqueline Brandão jumps rope as she warms up for practice. The 17-year-old has been coming here for more than a year. She's following a dream that's raised the eyebrows of people in her community. She's learning how to box, thanks to an organization called Luta pela Paz, or Fight for Peace.
My own father didn't want me to take up boxing. He thought it was a men's sport. In the beginning, the Fight for Peace program was only offered to boys, but a group of us girls got together and fought hard so we could join too. And now there are a couple of us who train here.
As the bell rings, other teenagers file in and start stretching out and jumping rope. Nearly 1,000 kids train here throughout the year, and most are boys. Jacqueline sits on the edge of the boxing ring and wraps up her hands with tape.
I do this to protect my hands from calluses and protect my wrists.
For Luke Dowdney, British boxing coach and founder of the project, boxing is also helping protect the favela's young people from a life of crime. Dowdney was once a professional boxer, but after getting injured in the ring, he dedicated himself to training kids in the favelas.
Boxing, I think, is a brilliant way to give young people a platform on which they can build. And what I mean by that is it's a great way for a young person to learn about themselves, about self-discipline, about dedication, about never winning unless you train hard. And so all in all, it's about building on top of that platform for life, because what you learn in a boxing ring can be taken to the rest of your life.
And kids in Complexo da Maré could really use those lessons. Here, people live crammed into tiny concrete shacks built up like catacombs, a no-man's land where drug gangs are the law. On this street, music blares as pot-bellied men without shirts lounge in doorways drinking beer, and small boys in flip-flops kick around soccer balls in the alleys. A teenage kid with a striped tank top sits next to a backpack on a stoop, calmly cleaning his pistol. He's most likely a drug dealer. In the favela, guns and gang wars are a daily part of life. But what's new, experts say, is that armed violence on the part of women is on the rise. As more and more women enter Brazil's massive drug trade, prisons in Rio and São Paulo are filling with female convicts. Luke Dowdney believes that boxing can attract even the toughest kids, whether boys or girls, away from crime and guide them into a better future.
So, I mean, think what boxing's about is saying to kids there are other things that you can do where you're going to get a similar amount of recognition, because we're putting on boxing shows in the community with 2,000 people coming to watch. So you're going to get the same kind of recognition, the same kind of props, the same kind of respect through something that's very positive, which is good for your life, rather than something which is not only bad for your life but bad for other people's.
Back at the gym, 15-year-old Natalia Queiroz scuffles in front of a boxing bag in flip-flops. She says it's hard to grow up in the favela because there are so few opportunities for people to study, get a decent job, and have a normal life. But learning to punch has helped her to manage her emotions.
When I am hitting that bag, I can let out all of my feelings, especially anger. I love it. I can express myself. Just let everything inside come out.
Natalia and her trainer face off in the ring. She in gloves and he in flat catcher's mitts. As she slams punches into his upturned hands, he encourages her to hit harder. Natalia's eyes shine with determination. She says learning to box has taught her to have confidence to get over every obstacle and reach her goals, no matter how outlandish they might seem.
My personal goal is to be a surgeon one day, and I will. Everything that you gain in your life comes from confidence. If you don't believe in yourself, you will go nowhere. You have to dream.
Flight for Peace may help Natalia achieve her dream of becoming a surgeon. The organization helps kids pay for part of their studies and mentors them in choosing a career. For Fight for Peace, boxing is more than learning how to punch. It's about learning to believe in yourself and have the courage to fight the odds for a better future. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amelia de Souza in Rio de Janeiro.
Brazilian music is best known for the bossa nova and the samba, but today, this is what's top of the pops there.
Não era pra você se apaixonar, era só pra gente ficar.
It's called Cora Me Liga, and it's sung by João Bosco and Vinicius. When we think of Hong Kong, we think high-rise and high-tech. But reporter Judith Ritter found something entirely different in the streets of the city. Here's the latest in our Street Vendor series.
There are still alleyways and jumbled streets here where clutters of vendors hawk everything from gnarled dried mushrooms to baskets of fish heads to jade amulets. Just on the edge of one of these chaotic marketplaces, Mr. Choi Long Tong sits at a worn little table. He has a stack of papers, some pens, and an old typewriter in front of him. Choi sells his services as a scribe. He tells me about the old days when many people were illiterate. So for a half century, he hand-wrote and later typed all kinds of forms and documents, death notices, job applications, and his big seller, complaint letters. Choi, a thin man with wisps of gray hair, sighs and says, times have changed.
In the old days, everyone needed letters of complaint. I was very busy then. Today, you can make a complaint with a phone call.
But it's the loss of another aspect of his job that really makes him sad. He used to write many love letters.
People would ask me to write their words, things like, you're a charming guy, you're beautiful, and I would find a good Chinese poem or special word to include. But nowadays people have more education, so they can write letters themselves.
He shows me his old typewriter. In a concession to modernity, he bought it some years ago. I ask him if any customers these days are willing or need to shell out about $4 for a page of typed or handwritten letter.
Yesterday, not one. Zero.
Choi knows this is the end of the line, not just for his job, but for the trade itself. He lives hand to mouth now, but still has a great feeling of satisfaction thinking about all the people he helped find love or work.
Some clients asked me to fill out forms to get jobs. Later, when some of them came back and told me they got the jobs, it was good news for me. I got to enjoy the happiness with them.
He smiles, studies his hands, fiddles with a small piece of jade he has for good luck. He looks out at the market, scanning the crowd for that one possible customer who just might show up today. For the World Vision Report, I'm Judith Ritter in Hong Kong.
The establishment of a unity government in Zimbabwe was widely regarded as a hopeful sign that change was on its way. But the arrest this week of opposition supporters calls that into question. Meanwhile, thousands of Zimbabweans are still trying to escape the country's economic collapse. Most of them flee illegally to South Africa, which is just across the border. Zimbabwean reporter Tendai Maposa just returned from South Africa. I asked him whether the refugees he met there were better off.
A lot of the Zimbabweans that I spoke to actually said that they think it would be better to go back home because they thought it was very easy to get a job in South Africa. But having crossed the border, they realized that that was not the case. A lot of them were just as destitute as they were back in Zimbabwe. But on the other hand, they know what the situation is like back home.
Right. So they're really stuck in a way, aren't they? There aren't jobs in Zimbabwe, but the unemployment rate is also very high in South Africa.
Absolutely. But, you know, in South Africa, there's always that, for some of them, there's always the hope that maybe they will get something to do.
Is there any glimmer of hope at all in Zimbabwe? You live there. What are people waiting for now?
People are hoping that, you know, this so-called government of national unity is going to bring about change. To start with, I mean, since this government came into being some 2 months ago, we've already noticed that a lot of changes in terms of prices of basic goods going down and basic goods just being available, which wasn't the case before. Inflation has really gone down now because we're using foreign money, hard currency, United States dollars, South African rand, etc., etc. The schools are now open again. Some of the hospitals are now open again. And people are just hoping that the international community will deliver in terms of aid to help with Zimbabwe's economic recovery. So this is what everybody is waiting for.
Are you encouraged?
As far as I'm concerned, the jury is still out because there's still a lot of things that are happening here. Very harsh media laws are still in place, and I haven't seen too much to encourage me personally. But I think this is the best of a bad situation, what we have now. We just wait to see what happens.
Tendai, why do you stay as a journalist under such rough conditions?
I think you'd ask that question of any Zimbabwean, and for me the answer is that this is the only place where I can stay without having to apply or to be humiliated into asking for a visa to stay, going through all that my compatriots are going through, not just in South Africa, but in other places all over the world. This is my home.
Tendai Maposa, thank you for speaking with us again.
You're most welcome, Peggy.
You might have seen this video that went viral on YouTube a few months ago. Now, we introduce you to the man who put the music together. Stay with us. You gonna need somebody to stand by you. No matter how much money you got. I'm Peggy Waymire, and you're back with the World Vision Report. Mexico is slowly getting back to normal after the swine flu epidemic shut down schools, shops, and businesses. The people worst hit by the closures were the ones who make a living on the street, vendors and beggars. Not that their lives were easy before. Here's Conrad Fox with a day in the life of Jorge Gonzalez.
A neighbor helps Jorge Gonzalez navigate his wheelchair over roots, stones, and drainage ditches. It's early morning, and he's on the way from his small cinder block house to the village bus stop. His legs and hands are stunted and withered, almost beyond recognition. Physical deformities he's had since birth. He has just enough strength to propel his wheelchair along a flat, paved surface. But 5 days a week, he struggles onto a bus and heads to the city of Minatitlan, an hour and a half away. With the help of the bus driver, Jorge hauls himself up into a seat, his wheelchair folded behind him. He's been doing this ever since his father died 4 years ago. Before then, he never left his village.
I was afraid to come to the city. I never went anywhere. I couldn't. But a neighbor encouraged me, and yeah, one day, I got on the bus and went to town, alone, completely alone. I'd never been to a city before. The first time, I just stayed in the bus terminal for 4 hours. But then I lost my fear. Now I come and I go as I want to.
Jorge comes to the city to beg. It's the only way he knows to make money. After the bus drops him off, he must catch a taxi to the city center. There isn't a wheelchair ramp in sight. Taxis pass him by to pick up able-bodied passengers just down the block.
It can be tough. They don't want to pick me up. Some of them can be a bit rude about it. Maybe it's because they don't want to get dirty, and I understand. Sometimes my wheelchair is really dirty. I sympathize. What can you do?
Eventually, a driver does stop and patiently helps him into the car. And when he arrives at the city center, a street vendor immediately wheels him to his regular post in front of a hotel. Even before he's had time to get out his cup, someone's pressed a 10 peso coin, worth about a dollar, into his hand. Most of that will go to his family.
Even if there's nothing left for me, I've got to support them so they can survive. I've got to buy their food, pay for their school. But it's been such a bad week. Today, they didn't take anything to eat, but they're used to it.
Jorge shakes a small plastic cup up and down and smiles calmly as shoppers and business people drop in coins. He estimates he earns about $150 to $200 a month, if he's lucky.
Some days I despair when I haven't got enough in my cup. I feel bad. I think, man, like last night. I come home feeling bad and there's my mom crying. This life I've got. I can't do anything else, just this. What else is there?
But most of the time, he's more upbeat. An avid singer, he passes the day humming to the music in the plaza. A group of girls from his community walk by and gather round. Jorge admits that when he first started begging, he felt ashamed when people he knew saw him. But now, he says, he loves the company. When the girls leave, he's smiling broadly. Does he have a girlfriend?
No, es secreto. Era compañera de la escuela.
There was one girl I serenaded a while back, but she didn't fall for me. I don't know.
No sé, por mi físico, no sé qué rollo.
Maybe because of my body.
Porque no le canté bien.
Or maybe I didn't sing well enough for her.
By 3 o'clock, the sun is blazing hot, and it's time to go. Jorge reaches around to a bag hanging from the back of his wheelchair and takes out his watch. He took it off in the morning. He says he doesn't want people thinking he's too rich. Back at the bus station, he sits patiently waiting as bus after bus fills up. He's too shy to ask for help, and waits almost an hour until a driver offers to lift him and his wheelchair up onto the bus. He'll be back by 6 o'clock, but his day isn't over yet. In Wasantlan, a neighbor wheels Jorge to the church. It's choir practice tonight.
Bueno, pues en la iglesia, pues yo encuentro, pues, primero, amistades.
In the church, I find, first, friendship.
Lo más importante es con Jesús, ¿no?
The most important of those is with Jesus.
Pues sí, he encontrado, pues, ¿cómo te digo?
I find, how can I say it? A peace inside of me that nobody, nothing can stop me.
Tomorrow, Jorge will attend his high school equivalency classes. He's behind in his tuition and didn't make enough to cover it today. Even so, he's convinced that one day, when he graduates, he'll get a job and won't have to beg anymore. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Wasantlan, Mexico.
This song might be familiar, but the singers probably aren't. That's because they're mostly unknown musicians from around the world. They can all be heard on a new CD and DVD called Playing for Change, Peace Through Music. It's the brainchild of music producer Mark Johnson. He traveled the world, adding new voices to the project as he went. Mark joins us from Los Angeles to tell us about his decade-long journey. You spent about 10 years traveling around the world to create a mix of performers and instruments playing together, while at the same time they're worlds apart. How did you come up with the vision for this?
Well, the idea for Playing for Change came about 10 years ago, as I was working in New York City at a recording studio as a recording engineer, and I was in the subway station, and most of the days in the subway, everybody would just run by each other. But this one day I was there and there were these two monks. One of them was playing a nylon guitar and the other one was singing. And I don't know in what language, and I imagine most people didn't know the language. But on that one day, about 200 people just stopped. Nobody got on the train. And everybody was watching this performance, and I saw people with tears in their eyes, and people were really happy, and I had the idea, you know, listen, music is the best way to bring people together, and it really exists just as moments in time. It's all over. So that's when I realized that if I traveled around the world with recording equipment and cameras, searching for those moments, I could really try to find a way to inspire the planet.
And you recorded more than 100 musicians. I'm wondering, how did you choose each musician, and how did you actually get this to work, playing the same song in different countries?
Well, it was sort of an evolving process. So I knew that in order to create a project like Playing for Change, we'd have to have as many different groups as possible playing music together to try to show the connection we all have as the human race. So with that in mind, I knew that I wanted to try to get different types of instruments playing together that ordinarily wouldn't be something people would hear. So I knew that I wanted to add South African choirs and sitars in Asia, combining with steel guitars in New Orleans, try to come up with things that would be very unique and would find some way of showing people these connections that different types and different styles of music have. And then as I was walking down the street in Santa Monica, where I live, I heard Roger Ridley singing the song Stand By Me from about three blocks away. And I ran over to watch his performance, and it was just so full of soul and emotion. And then it occurred to me, well, what a great song for the world to sing together, Stand By Me. That's really the first step of what we need to do is stand by each other. So that's when I realized that this would be a great opportunity to take this song around the world. And that sort of led me on this whole course to try to add all these different cultures and instruments to the track.
So you started with a song like Stand By Me that most everyone knows, and you went to different parts of the world and had each person with a different instrument playing it, and then you came back and mixed it all.
Right, so they would all hear wherever the track was at that time. So after I recorded Roger, I went into New Mexico to the Zuni Indian Reservation and put headphones on 10 Indians around a drum, and they would hear Roger playing, and then they would play the drum. Then I went down to New Orleans and found Grandpa Elliot, one of the greatest street musicians in the world, put headphones on Grandpa, and he would hear the Indians with Roger. So everybody would hear whoever had preceded them on the track, and then they would find their own way of contributing to it.
Now, on the DVD, I think one of my favorite ones was a song that, it's a rendition of Bob Marley's song, War No More Trouble. And I should say that all the musicians in all the locations are from pretty troubled places where there has been a lot of war and conflict. So when they're singing and you're watching them in these settings, you can see the pain and the sadness and the hope.
Right. Well, you know, it's really, this whole project is about getting back to the roots of what music is about. Music is just about one heart speaking to another heart with a direct line. With War No More Trouble, the idea with that one came as we were traveling around the world, we realized that as a human race, we have to go from the darkness to the light in a lot of places because there is a lot of struggle and conflicts. So this was the idea of this song is that the first part of the song explains why are we at war, why are there conflicts in the world? And the second part of the song is the resolution. We don't need any more trouble. What we need is love. So as I was working on this song, I wanted to have mostly musicians from conflict regions uniting together to kind of make this collective statement. So I started with musicians in South Africa and musicians from the Congo and Zimbabwe, added musicians in the Middle East, Israel, Palestine. Then when I went to add a Northern Ireland Catholic Protestant children's choir. And in that process, you know, I'd always been a huge fan of Bono, and to me he has one of the most amazing voices. So the lyric that I really wanted him to sing in that song is, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, everywhere is war.
until there are no longer first class, second class citizens of any nation. Until the color of man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, everywhere is war.
I want to understand your vision. It's a beautiful thing to bring all these people together from war-torn countries and bring the best musicians and have positive, upbeat music. But how is that going to affect, let's say, children on the streets in Ghana?
The reality is that music and inspiration, they open the door. People that see these videos and hear these songs can see a connection that otherwise maybe wasn't as possible. So instead of being isolated into different groups where this group is against that group, we need to understand that we're all part of the same group, the human race. And so the way it's going to help children around the world is that by inspiring people to feel more connected first to themselves and their place in the world, and then to others around them, we can actually create a world where kids tomorrow have less violence, less conflicts, and less war.
There are going to be a lot of people who have to hear this music and be inspired by it in order for there to be a real shift of any sort. How are you going to get this music to people?
Right. Well, I guess there's two main concepts here. One of them is that at any moment, people can change their lives. We have the choice. So the idea is we can use music to inspire people. And one person who could have created a lot of negativity in the world, if they're inspired, perhaps they go a different direction. So you never know what one individual can actually do to change the world. And that also leads to sort of that butterfly effect. By creating something positive, it could actually affect people in ways you never even can measure. And that's really what we're trying to do, just create positive, inspirational musical collaborations and then see where that takes us.
Mark, one of the musicians, one of the African musicians on the DVD says of music, where there is the greatest tragedy, there is the greatest art. Did you see that in your travels over the years putting this project together?
Definitely. It's an interesting phenomenon. You know, wherever you go in the world where there have been the most struggles and the poorest places in the world, you do find the most spirit and the most powerful art. I think one of the musicians told us in South Africa, people play music here to stay as far away from the grave as possible. And you know, to be honest with you, I never even imagined such a thing was true. You know, here we play music to celebrate. Maybe there's a protest song. Maybe there's a party song. But you know, to play music just to simply stay alive, I mean, that just shows the power of the human spirit. It also shows the importance of music's involvement in who we are as people.
Now, the title of your CD and the DVD is Playing for Change, and that is obviously speaking of the deep change that you've spoken about here. But you're also using money that you've raised for this project to bring some small concrete changes to some of the places you've visited. You have a foundation. Where's the money going?
Proceeds, you know, a percentage of proceeds from the record, it goes to the Playing for Change Foundation. As we were traveling the world, we realized, you know, we need to give back to the communities that were letting us in their homes, playing us their music, feeding us, telling us their stories. But, you know, it goes much deeper than that. It's really, if you want to create a movement, something to really inspire the planet, it has to involve the creation of these songs around the world and the visual media to represent it. But it also needs to have a movement where music schools and positive things are being built in the communities that we're working with around the world. So we decided to create the Playing for Change Foundation. We just finished building the first music school in Guguletu Township, South Africa. So in the middle of a million shacks is this beautiful school. And actually in the Stand By Me video, the bass player in that exact spot, he's playing in front of some shacks. Now there's a beautiful school there for the community, but the vision is much bigger. It's really like the Stand By Me track. You know, it starts with one man and a guitar and ends with about 40 people that never met playing together. Same thing with the schools. Start with one school, put recording equipment and cameras in there so people can log into the internet. They can watch performances in the schools, break down that distance barrier, and then connect all the schools that we build over time together.
Why music schools? When some might say there are other more tangible things needed that have to do with food and medicine and shelter.
Well, the truth is that we're not only building music schools. That's the central premise was we asked the communities, what could we do to help you? So in South Africa, they said music schools. But in northern India, in Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama lives, we're actually just working to rebuild the refugee centers so that they can get food, clothing, and a sense of decency. So really, it's just about creating, you know, first what these people need to collectively come together and be proud of themselves and have an opportunity. And then once that's established, then we try to provide them with artistic inspiration such as music and art schools.
Ready? One, two, three.
Mark Johnson, producer of Playing for Change, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Mark Johnson is producer and director of the newly released CD called Playing for Change, Peace Through Music. It's currently being distributed through Starbucks. You can see video of the project at our website, worldvisionreport.org.
What am I gonna do now?
And we'll go out today on music from Playing for Change. Remember, you can download a podcast or read blogs from our reporters at our website, worldvisionreport.org. And if you're on Facebook, become a fan of the World Vision Report. Click on the Facebook icon on our website. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Our assignment editor is Lita Hartman. Our producers are Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Susan Shepherd. Larry Short is our interactive editor. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
I'm gonna teach myself how to understand. Gonna make myself a better man.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.